Hi, welcome to Offscript. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at Begonia, the new Yorgos Lanthimos film is out, Kinds of Kindness, The Favorite, a bunch of other stuff he's made. Anyway, we've seen the movie. It stars Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons, a couple other characters, when a couple of young men kidnap a powerful female CEO, assuming that she's an alien. And they have to get to the bottom of it by the end of the feature. We're going to take a look at Ballad of a Small Player over on Netflix. This is a new Edward Berger feature, right? All Quiet on the Western Front, Edward Berger. Conclave, Edward Berger. Kind of a smaller joint. Stars Colin Farrell as a down-on-his-luck gambler in Macau at the edge of the world, just trying to get one more W before all of his debts come calling in. Yeah, that's what we're talking about this week on the show. We're going to take a look at a little bit of TV, a real quick TV corner. Really just want to talk about this I Love LA show starring Rachel Sunnow and Welcome to Dario over on HBO. We'll talk about that in between our episodes. Before we get to all of it, in between our reviews, excuse me, I'm just blasting through this thing. Before we get to all of it, we talk about the news. Our first story this week, we got some news about Godzilla. Yeah, the new Godzilla movie from Toho Studios. If you're a Godzilla fan, then you know very well about Godzilla Minus One. It's incredible success. What was it, just last year that movie came out? Now people are looking forward to what's next. We have some details. What do we know about new Godzilla?
Well, yesterday, November 3rd, was International Godzilla Day, and so this is when this announcement came out. But the sequel to Godzilla Minus One is going to be creatively called Godzilla Minus Zero, which you might have thought the numbers were going the opposite way. But in case you don't know or don't remember, it was called Godzilla Minus One because in the teaser it explained after the nuclear bombs were dropped on Japan, Japan had lost everything. They were from zero to minus. And so this insinuates a coming back, rebuilding, but maybe of the monster itself. People pointed out the logo is slightly different. And the first logo is clearly Godzilla. So maybe this is something else, some sort of different villain. So that's going to be exciting. They're aiming for a late 2026 release, probably around Christmas. Probably going to be bigger in scale, budget, scope, all that. So I'm excited to see.
Yeah, Godzilla Minus One was an unexpected success. Obviously, there's a few decades, more than a few decades, of Godzilla films coming out of Japan, all of which have a unique response to nuclear fallout and like kind of the result of World War II and bombs being dropped on Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Godzilla is kind of like uniquely placed as this large like monster of pop culture that is kind of a direct response to that, right? He's like created by radiation. He rains devastation down on cities like he is seemingly immutable in regards to politics. He does not care. He's just this kind of wanton creature of destruction. And Godzilla Minus One took the franchise in a new kind of different direction by going backwards. Right. It's a period piece. And it's kind of set right after the war about this young fighter pilot who's come back home and didn't survive the war unexpectedly. And when he was meant to die. And that's when we stumble into Godzilla, and Godzilla arrives and makes landfall. We covered it on the show, a really good time if you never ended up seeing it, and it's a big part of the reason why people are looking forward to what's happening in this next installment, because, yeah, that kind of picks up at least similarly in universe vein. We're not going to be like far-flung future or anything crazy. I think we're going to be kind of following that film. Don't know if we'll have the same characters. Pretty mum on details. But even still, it's good a lot of that creative talent is coming back, because that was a much needed boon for the Godzilla franchise. Why not, right? Like, why not get more people in? Actually did pretty well here, too, in the United States, if I remember correctly. Like, that movie was doing numbers. They put out a black and white edition. And I know we covered it on the pod, so if you're watching on YouTube, you can roll back and see our reviews of that on the channel. I've run out of things to say about Godzilla.
Academy Award winning film.
Did it really? What won the Academy Award for?
Best visual effects.
Oh my god, that's right. Yeah, and on a shoestring budget too. They're running it lean over there. Speaking of big visuals, we got to talk about the new Call of Duty movie. Yeah, so Taylor Sheridan's doing a Call of Duty movie. Yellowstone's Taylor Sheridan is doing a Call of Duty movie, namely with Peter Berg directing. Big video game movie news. What do you know about this, Andy?
I mean, Taylor Sheridan, we were talking last week during our Kevin Costner hit piece that Taylor Sheridan is king of Hollywood now. It's interesting how the power has kind of shifted to the content creators, the writers in this case. But Taylor Sheridan is leaving Paramount But it going to NBC Universal, that was the big shocker over the weekend. But he's still going to be staying on for the Call of Duty movie at Paramount. So he's just kind of getting everything. He also has a lucrative TV deal in 2028. He's going to go back to making some films. He was known for, we reviewed Hell or High Water, which is a great neo-Western. He also did Lone Survivor and Friday Night Lights and those kinds of films. And so he knows this genre, but he's going to be writing the Call of Duty film. And we've talked about how video games are kind of the next, they're what comic book films were a decade ago. It's the hot property that the kids are going to see. Call of Duty's been the best-selling video game for like 15 years, or one of the best. I don't know the story. There's a lot of different characters and stories. I mean, it's mostly just about shoot 'em up. So I don't know what kind of story they're going to develop, but yeah. They're doing it.
I can weigh in on that a little bit, actually. Call of Duty has been running for a really long time, and there's a few different kind of storylines in the franchise, but kind of the main most successful one comes from the Modern Warfare series. It started way back in, 2004 or something at first. I think the first 2008, maybe the first Modern Warfare game came out. 2006? Somewhere in there. Since then, there have been remakes and variations and expansions, but this kind of core crew in that game, led by... This kind of Scottish captain named Captain Price, who fights for the good guys, of course, his goofy hat and a big mustache. He's in there. There's a couple other characters that are kind of recurring. There's one guy named Ghost who wears this mask with like a skull on it. There's a character named Soap McTavish, you play in the first game. I would bet almost anything, based on what we know of adaptation and where Hollywood likes to spend their dollars, they're going to go with that. It's the most successful kind of like storyline that they've built on in the Call of Duty games. It would be a layup. I rattled off a tweet earlier this week saying they should fan cast Gerard Butler as Captain Price. Kind of got the accent. He's older. I think it'd work great. There's a bunch of people that were like, no, they should do this person. Or yeah, that's a good pick. Like lots of angles. And also Peter Berg directing is a great pick. Lone Survivor, Deepwater Horizon, Friday Night Lights. He collaborated with Taylor Sheridan previously on Hell or High Water, like you mentioned. So like, seems like a winning combo. They are going to throw so much money at this thing, dude. Call of Duty is the biggest first-person shooter franchise in existence. Like, this thing is going to be a really big deal. So, yeah. And like you said, like, one of many, I think, video game projects coming down the pike. Like, we got, like, an Elden Ring movie they're working on. Nintendo's doing Mario and Zelda. Like, it's the age of video game cinema is nigh upon us, it seems like, and this is just a step towards that.
What's interesting is I heard a comparison that, 10, 15 years ago, this is what the Halo movie was. Forever, the Halo movie was, it was gonna be Peter Jackson, it was gonna be this director, or is that, and it just never happened.
Yeah.
Which is real tragic, but this has kind of happened with the Call of Duty movie as well. It's kind of been bouncing around, and it's finally landed at home, and also the right time in the kind of the genre that the films that are successful and that Hollywood's going to invest in now. So it'll be interesting to see. It's probably a couple years away.
Yeah. And fitting, you mentioned the Halo project. Like, that was supposed to be a Paramount picture for a really long time. They ended up turning it into a television series, got a couple seasons out of it. And then they ported it over to Netflix, where it's kind of lit. It's dead. They're not making any more of it, but it's doing really big numbers over there. Netflix, God, I think they had talked about doing a BioShock movie for years. Gears of War was supposed to get a movie adaptation. Like, yeah, all of these popular video game franchises that people who listen to this show probably never heard of, have been kind of kicked around by Hollywood, but no one's ever taken the plunge. But following the success of Mario, man, it just seems like the floodgates are open. We're just going to do it, right? We're going to make as much video game stuff as we can. So keep it here on Offscript for more. Another story real quick. Netflix might be buying Warner Brothers. Or at least is thinking about buying Warner Brothers. This is a story out of Deadline. Last week we mentioned that Warner Brothers' historic studio has put itself up for sale. They're hoping somebody will buy them. It's up in the air who's going to do it, but Netflix might take the plunge. What do you know about it?
So this has been in the works for a couple of years. We knew that Warner Brothers was wanting to move towards acquisition. They split the company into, they kind of split the traditional TV and sports stuff into one company, and the streaming and studio business into another one, and that's what they're trying to sell, and that's the big buy. That's what everyone wants. We saw that Paramount had made two, possibly three bids for Warner Brothers, which have all been soundly rejected. The scuttlebutt is that Netflix is also maybe looking into, which would be wild and would take us down from five major studios to four. I think that's correct. Disney, Sony, Universal, Paramount, basically at that point. But it does look like they're pretty serious, because it was Warner Brothers themselves who have allowed this finance company to come in and appraise them, get a look at their books, and see what kind of valuation there actually is. But it's going to be crazy, but they do look like they're seriously looking to be bought, and it's just going to be, you know, fewer studios moving closer towards a content monopoly, which is kind of scary. I hope it's not Netflix, at least, because Netflix does not believe in theaters, and they will make everything for straight to TV. So
I tell you,
I'm not looking forward to that.
Dude, I don't know who the winners are in the Warner Brothers buyout. Like, cause I don't want Paramount Skydance to take them, right? Like, please don't let Paramount get a hold of these people. Like, Warner Brothers is likely, for many like cinema fans out there, kind of the golden goose of properties right now. Like, between what they're doing with A24 and their partnerships with Criterion and Turner Classic Movies, which they own, like, between like the shows they offer on HBO and their staggering content library of just like banger after banger after banger after banger. The HBO Sunday slate is like coveted, right? Among streamers, like, everybody wishes they could be HBO, and everybody that isn't HBO like is angling to work alongside them, it seems, anybody with success. So, like, I don't want Netflix to buy them, because Netflix won't put stuff in theaters, and I don't want Paramount to buy them, because Paramount just seems to be on this huge spending spree, and it doesn't seem to be working out very well for them, and I don't think it's worth putting them over there. So I don't know. Who would you want to get Warner Brothers? Like, if you could have your way, who buys them, do you think?
I would rather it be one of the big traditional studios, Universal, Disney, Paramount in this case seems to be the closest one, only because the legacy studios still believe in the theatrical model. Yes, they all have streaming services as well, but at least they believe in the big screen, whereas Netflix absolutely does not. They want to see the end of theaters. They would like for people to never go to theaters again. They're anticipating that we won't have theaters in 20 years. They're always saying that. So I don't think Netflix is the way to go. Imagine all your DC properties, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, all those things just being on Netflix, and new properties being invested at the Netflix rate and look and feel and all that. I just don't think that's good for the industry.
Yeah. I guess if I had to say one, if I had to pick, like, just if I could have my way, I'd snap my fingers. They got to get bought. Somebody's got to take them. I guess I'd rather be independent, but if I couldn't, I guess Universal. I like what Universal's doing. I think Universal's got a lot of good ideas. They got a really cool talent pool over there. They're signing a lot of cool deals with companies like or directors like Nolan, Daniels, Jordan Peele is doing his projects over there, right? They're trying to get Zach Cregger over from Weapons. Like, Universal's signing some cool deals. I guess I would want them to do it. But, like, man, competition's good, and it bums me out that Warner Brothers is like, somebody else drive for a while. You know, it's a bummer. We got to talk about the box office real quick before we move into Begonia. October was bad. October was real bad for the box office. give your movie friends a hug, all right? Because October wasn't good. And it's a shame, because it seemed like a really adventurous month, but people have just not turned out. What's going on?
Box Office Massacre is the title of this article from the Hollywood Reporter. Revenue falls to 27-year low, the lowest in nearly 30 years, excluding the pandemic month of October, when there were no movies and people weren't going. It's been bad. It's been real bad, and there's a number of reasons. It's a lack of product. We usually have a couple of bigger, like, either superhero stuff or just something big. And the big movie was Tron: Ares, and it was a bomb. And that was the biggest thing. Last year, Venom: Save the Last Dance was the big hit, and those Venom films have done very well. Things like Joker also came out in October in the past, but there was just nothing. The two big releases was Dwayne Johnson's The Smashing Machine, and of course Tron: Ares, and both bombed hugely. The indie didn't catch on. Tron: Ares didn't catch on either, and the rest has just not been a whole lot to choose from. Some smaller releases like Black Phone 2, but yeah, just huge lack of product, and, you know, people just aren't going to the movies as much.
It is really funny that looking at the numbers, a notable reason that we got to where we did get in October for the meager earnings that are here is because of Taylor Swift's movie, the official release party of Showgirl, which wasn't a
That's
movie.
Right.
Yeah, it was like a cinematic event, right? It was a music video and then a bunch of behind the scenes stuff for like 70 minutes or something. But that came out at the beginning of October, made almost $35 million. Oh, from the October 3rd to 5th weekend. So that's notable. Also, God, we kept talking about on this show, dude, like anime movies, Chainsaw Man, right? Demon Slayer pulled money, I think, the month before. Like, those have been a big deal. Otherwise, like, man, the Bruce Springsteen biopic Delivery from Nowhere was a big bust. Smashing Machine was a bust. Black Phone 2 is doing fine. Mason Thames has another rom-com out, Regretting You, also from Paramount, which I think is just doing... okay. Notably, Mortal Kombat 2 was supposed to come out from Warner Brothers this month, but it got pushed back to May. And there's been some other stuff that's been getting pushed around, too. Somebody just asked me the other day when Project Hail Mary's coming out, and I was like, oh, that got pushed. Like, that thing, things have been moved around a little bit. But yeah, just a real, real slow Halloween season. Really a bummer. And Halloween was on a Friday, for God's sake. Like, you'd think... You'd think the studios would put out something on a Friday, but I think, I don't know. I think people were just hanging out for the weekend.
People were out. Also, the World Series was over the weekend. I don't know how much that affects it, but that was could also be a cause. So, real rough. Let's get into some numbers. The winner over the weekend was Black Phone 2 at $8.3 million. It's made over $100 million worldwide, so that's a big hit for Blumhouse, who needed a win this year. And they were neck and neck with Regretting You, which is the Colleen Hoover adaptation, which is at $8.1 million, $50 million worldwide. That's doing well for the size of movie. Colleen Hoover continues to print money. At number three is Chainsaw Man, the movie Reza Arc, that's made $6 million over the weekend, but $140 million worldwide. That's a big hit. That's been out for a few weeks as well in Japan. It only recently was released here. Bugonia, which we're going to be talking about briefly. In just a second, $4.8 million, $11 million worldwide, about what we expected for an indie. And then rounding out the top five was the Back to the Future 40th Annual re-release at $4.7 million. Like, new films can't compete with the classics. It's bad. It's yeah. Real bad, but that's what the box office has been doing this weekend.
Dude, I'm a big Back to the Future fan. Like, I love those movies. I got a couple of the posters. Like, I really go for those flicks. And like, I bought the DVD set years ago and I was good. I don't even have it on Blu-ray, right? And like, now, just the other day, I saw they got like a Back to the Future 4K collection. It's like $150. It comes with like a flux capacitor and like a fake license, like everything, right? And I'm thinking, like, who the hell is buying this stuff? Like, who really cares? And then it makes $5 million in theaters. Like, come on. Come on, dude. Like, I went and saw Bugonia last night. I caught a late show. And they had a couple of Back to the Future screenings. There are people milling about. There are people going in and out of the Back to the Future screenings. So, glad people still like it. Stunned that people are still paying for it. Like, I feel like I've burned the brakes off those movies. Anyway. Just a slow Halloween weekend. Do you think things are going to pick up going into the holidays here? I mean, typically the holidays are a pretty good season, but like, do you think this is a bellwether of maybe a slow end to 2025?
I mean, I think it's been a bit of a down year in general. Even the summer was lighter than it normally was, even the last 2 years. I think November will be better. There's a lot more things coming out to look forward to. We have The Running Man, Wicked for Good, Zootopia 2, a bunch of small indies are also coming out. Jay Kelly, Christie, Knives Out 3, Wake Up Dead Man. So I think there's way better product and better selection this month. And then October was just real light. And we were wondering, like, why are all the horror? Why have you not released? There's like three horror movies coming out in November. I was like, why weren't these released a month ago during spooky season?
Yeah, how strange. Really pulling for, God, I just saw the trailer for Running Man again last night. God, I hope that movie's good. I watched Hot Fuzz not long ago, and it's like, I see a little bit of that Edgar Wright action in there. I would love for this to be a banger, but we'll see. With that, we should move into our first film of the episode. Andy's going to be taking the summary on this one, so I will get out of his way. Andy, please, take it away.
Bugonia. So this is the much-anticipated film from director Yorgos Lanthimos, big favorite on this show, previously known for The Favorite, Poor Things, Kinds of Kindness, The Lobster, has a very unique style. The Poor Things was an awards hit, a financial hit, and a big awards hit. Emma Stone won her second Oscar for that role. So here we are. This is actually based on a 2000. It's a bit of a remake based on a 2003 Korean film called Save the Green Planet. Yorgos Lanthimos got his hands on the script, reworked it with writer Will Tracy to be more in line with his style of filmmaking and in English, of course. And they went to it. The movie stars Jesse Plemons as Teddy. He is a worker bee. He lives in this really dilapidated house with his cousin Don. They're both just kind of greasy, unkempt losers. But they're conspiracy theorists. They're way down the well, and they're convinced that the CEO of the company that they work for, Michelle Fuller, played by the great Emma Stone, is an alien. And they're convinced that she's here to destroy the world because the bees are dying. And that's how a lot of sci-fi stuff starts. It has this premise of the bees are dying. So the bees are dying, and it's because of this person who's an alien running this evil corporation killed the bees. They hatch a plan to kidnap her. And I'm not sure what their plan is after that, but they plan to kidnap her, which they do in very comic fashion because they are buffoons. They shave her head immediately because they said that's how she contacts the mothership. And they begin to interrogate her and kind of prove that she's an alien. And it becomes a battle of wills and wit and words because you have someone who is a conspiracy theorist and is convinced this person is an alien and someone else trying to convince them that they're not, that they're a regular person. And that's our really intense setup. Zach, what do you think?
So I think Begonia is a ton of fun, and I think it's super good. I am bummed that Yorgos Lanthimos is taking a break from filmmaking. I was just reading this morning. He is going to go take photos in Greece. That's what he's going to do. He's a Greek director, and he's like, I want to go take photos of the islands for 6 months. I want to take a break from making movies. I've been hitting him back to back to back, and he has, man. And it's a bummer because his collaborations with Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons and his cinematographer and his composer, whose name I can't recall right now, have all been tremendous. And Begonia's a delight to watch. Like, if you like Kinds of Kindness, you're going to like Begonia. If you like The Favorite, which is more accessible and very different, you're going to like Begonia. It's got a little bit of Killing a Sacred Deer. It's got a little bit of Dogtooth. It's got a little bit of everything in it. And it manages to be so enjoyable, despite the fact that it's not an original picture from him. It's kind of a remake. And originally wasn't even supposed to be headed up by him. It was supposed to be this other South Korean director who ended up not doing it. We've got a script from the writer of The Menu, who also worked on some episodes of Succession. We've got like really sharp dialogue, but creative control by Yorgos Lanthimos, who stepped in to kind of pick this one up and run with it. So much fun. So much fun. People are saying it's not his best. Debatable, probably not his best, but like just a great time at the movies. Goes in places I didn't expect. Simple setup. And I remember we heard about this setup like when we saw his last movie. We were talking about it just a couple weeks later. He had said like on red carpet, he's like, oh yeah, I'm doing this movie where the guys think she's an alien. Like they put that way out front. We were doing predictions a couple weeks ago on the pod on whether or not she was going to be an alien. Like just a whole kind of thing. And at the center of that, like an acting powerhouse from Stone and Plemons, who are playing opposite each other. These two characters were pretty similar in, I don't know, like lifestyle and approach to the world, but like couldn't be more polar opposites in standing and status. And like, that's such a great place to have this kind of classist, you know, debate over multiple days and what a person is and isn't and what their intentions really are.
Yeah, when I think back to something like Poor Things, that's probably his most accessible work, and also is probably most optimistic as well. But most of his stuff is kind of bleak. Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is an incredible movie, very bleak ending. Some of his other stuff, this is a little bit more in that, a little bit like Kinds of Kindness as well. Like things don't really go good for all of our characters involved. Zach, where do you want to start with this?
So I guess plot, right, and acting. I really want to talk about how it's shot. I really want to talk about the sound of it, the set design. Like, there's a lot of really cool things happening in the background of this movie, but probably just general, like, shape, right? Andy headed it up great. We've got Jesse Plemons, who is kidnapping Emma Stone because he is convinced that she is from the galaxy of Andromedon, and she is an alien from another place who has come here ultimately to destroy humanity. And Emma Stone, like, through kind of the setup of this movie, is played from far away. Like, we get a look at her, but she's kind of her own self-absorbed CEO. Remind me a lot of Lydia Tarr, like a woman who's like kind of fake, but like she is in a position of power and she's not letting go of it. And she holds it and she tells her coworkers like, hey, you guys can leave at 5:30. But ultimately, like, she's got a tone under her and she's got this big house she lives in and she takes vitamins in the morning and works out. And Plemons, meanwhile, is like a bum. Like, he looks like he hasn't showered in 9 years, and he's got this like long raggedy blonde hair. And his cousin Donnie, who's with him, is simple for sure. Played by the way, actor with, I think, actually has autism. Aiden Delbis is his name. It's his first on-screen role ever in this movie. Yorgos loves to pick like his locals, and these two like very clumsily grab Emma Stone, and that's when the movie turns into like a boiler pot of like acting class of the two of them kind of going back and forth, because Stone does not buy into any of this. She's like, you guys need to let me go, I'm a high profile CEO and you have no idea what you've done. And Plemons, meanwhile, is like, boy, you sure are frightening me, but you're an alien for sure. And we're going to get you to prove it. And it becomes this weird, like, cat and mouse of, like, truth and lie. And, like, these lines get blurred of what is real and what isn't and what do you believe and what don't you believe. And it all happens in this, like, wonderful little house set they've got. There's a basement, like, a couple other characters around the movie that I don't want to get into too much. But, man, just a delightful little setup for these two to bounce off each other.
Yeah, I love Stone's performance. When we first meet her, she's the epitome of that, like, girl boss CEO. She gets up at 4:30 in the morning. She does her she works out. She has like an MMA coach. Like, she's not easy for them to kidnap. They kind of bumble through, which is really funny. But yeah, she's just got she's in a terrible person in a position of power. Yeah, there's this great scene when she's saying, she's referring to some sort of an unpleasant incident, but she's like, you know, everyone can go home at 5:30, you know, if they feel like they're done, if they are done, but no pressure to stay, but you know, we all have our quotas. Like, it's this terrible, you can, but it's you
weird,
can't
double kind speak of thing. Yeah,
yeah. And she tries this on Teddy, because when she comes to in the basement that they've locked her in, they're like, you guys are idiots, I'm a high-powered, important lady.
Yeah,
the police are looking for me now. I have 2 degrees. Look, I have a degree in psychiatry. And Teddy is not smart, but he's not dumb either. And he's like prepared for all this, and he's prepared for all her mincing of words. And what it really, this reminded me of Eddington quite a bit, where it's about two sides of people who are unable to really talk to each other and try to listen to each other, because she soon finds that basically nothing she says will convince Teddy that she's not an alien.
Yeah. I think Lanthimos's films are often like thought of for their unique dialogue. That's one of the things. Characters are kind of monotone. He's gotten out of this a bit, but like notably, like Killing of a Sacred Deer is really good at this. And like The Lobster, both Colin Farrell features, he's in those movies. Like, all his characters speak very low and very direct and very like emotional. And that's how most of his scripts are. He's kind of aged out of it. He's moved into kind of like more direct emotional engagements between characters. But there's two films that he's adapted, like, or that he's jumped on, like a script that was already made that somebody else wrote that he jumped into. The Favorite and this movie, Begonia. And both of those movies, like The Favorite was kind of his first breakaway from his kind of like notable dialogue style. And this one is pretty far from it. But what you get when you don't have Yorgos Lanthimos like dialogue is like really, really, really sharp, modern, trendy, thoughtful lines about where we are as a society and whether Teddy is alt-right or an incel or both or a Marxist or neither, right? Or a communist or what his kind of angle is. Meanwhile, Emma Stone sees herself as a winner and he is a loser. And she's like, you're nothing. And when the cops get here, this is all over and it's going to be done with. But she also has to understand that this is like deadly serious and these guys are not normal and are not doing good. And that gives you the opportunity for like really great drama, something that's really contemporary that audiences connect with. And also these like wild swings in tone, which are like so wonderfully accentuated by Jerskyn Fendrick's. Jerskyn, is that the name, yep, right? Yeah, Jerskyn, yep, Fendrick's soundtrack here. Like, incredibly bombastic, wildly frightening. You'll have scenes that are dramatic and a little bit of funny that are immediately followed by, like, straight out of a horror movie stuff. Like, big, big crashes, right? Big cymbals. The orchestra comes screaming in on the soundtrack. Like, it just gives you, like, this crazy tonal experience of a back and forth.
Right. I also wanted to mention our third main actor in the movie, Aiden Delvis, who plays Donnie, who's the simple. He is a real life autistic person. And Lanthimos said they specifically looked for someone who hadn't done film yet. I'm sure he has some other acting background, but they were specifically looking for an unknown and specifically an autistic person in real life. And that is the term that Aiden Delvis prefers. And they had like a consultant on set, and we would walk him through whatever shot was happening, because they shot with these big VistaVision cameras that are real noisy and things. But what's interesting about his character is he's in the middle. He's going along with the plot, but he kind of doesn't want to. Like, he deep down, he kind of knows what they're doing isn't right, and that they shouldn't be like trapped to this woman. They shouldn't be hurting her. They shouldn't be doing these things. But he's kind of just very easily pushed around by whoever's loudest, whoever's in charge. Like when he's around Teddy kind of bullies him around. When he gets a couple of alone moments with Michelle, then she starts to kind of have his way. So he's a really interesting character in the middle, being pulled to either side.
Yeah, I thought through about the first half of the first act, I thought the main character might secretly be Don. I thought he might be kind of who we're following, because so much of the opening of the film is Teddy explaining to Don what's going on and how things are going to go. He's got to kind of set this up for him, right? Like, hey, cousin, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go over to her house. We're going to grab her, okay? You're going to shave her head, because if you don't, she can use her hair to talk to her mothership, right? Like, we're going to cover her in this, like, white cream stuff so that her neurons can't whatever. Like, you get some kind of goofy stuff, but then they get a gun out. And then suddenly it becomes very serious, right? And they get syringes out, and we're going to hit her with this sedative, and she's going to fall. And he's just like, oh, no, this is all really dangerous and bad. And I think Begonia's ability to, like, walk that line between normal and obscure, between, like, acceptable and frightening, both in, like, presentation and in ideology, and how Teddy talks about whether or not this is a real thing. And even if she's not an alien, she's still bad. Her company's still killing the beast, but she is an alien, of course. And, like, Don's not sure. And she's like, you guys are nuts. Like, get me out of here. Right. Like, then she starts to think, maybe if I play along with it, I can get out of here. Like, you start to get these really blurred lines of reality. And I think Begonia's script is largely due in part to that. Also, you're right. You mentioned VistaVision. This is one of three films shot on VistaVision that I know of this year. Brutalist, one battle after another, and this, right? So big wide lenses, really fantastic for this house set they've got. It makes it seem like the characters are really isolated and small in this kind of giant airy frame. Love the look of this movie.
Yeah, that's a good time to talk about how this is shot. Lanthimos is known especially for his lens choice, which he doesn't do a ton of in this. Things like The Favorite, he'll do lots of crazy fisheye lens things, or in Poor Things. There's a little bit of that. But what I notice is that the camera's always looking up at Jesse, and he looks alien almost himself, the way he talks, because he's just so convinced by this. He seems to not have pupils. His eyes just kind of look black, and he's so greasy and dirty. But a lot of times the camera will be out of focus, or it'll be focused just off to the side of the actor's face. Like it'll be like they're part of their forehead will be in focus and everything else is a little bit fuzzy. And there's a lot of that kind of neat filmmaking that in this, we get a little bit of that. Zach, what do you think?
Yeah, you're right. Plemons is like emaciated. Like he's a character that's in poverty, right? And like, she is so far from that. And even though like they both kind of live in the same town and both have these kind of similar shapes in their lives, they both get ready in the morning, they both exercise and take vitamins, like, and they both listen to music on their drive into work, although he's on a bike with crappy headphones and she's listening to, like, Chapel Roan in her, like, shiny Land Rover. Like, the two of them are not that far from one another, but, like, what they have between them is status and money and class, right? And, like, that gets interpreted in here as, like, you are distant and you are alien and you have means other than like what you say you have. I don't want to talk too much more about character. I feel like I keep looping back in on him, but like I really do want to watch it again. I feel like part of what's charming about Begonia is how things get recontextualized over the course of the movie. And as you learn more about the two of these characters, like you start to learn like, hey, when she was saying this in Act One, she maybe didn't mean that the way I thought. Or when Teddy was talking about this in Act Two, that was definitely something else. And like, I don't know. I think it makes for a real sharp experience. And I'm bummed he's taking a break. Like, I'm bummed that Yorgos Lanthimos isn't going to pick this back up anytime soon.
What do you think about the Oscar chances of these? There's talk of Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons being in the best actor race.
I think the nomination potential is very high. I think it's weird. Like, typically the Academy does not go for stuff like this. It was like a breakout year when they put Everything Ever All at Once up. When Parasite did good, that was like insane. It was like, oh my God, like nobody thought they'd go for something like this. And then sometimes they throw up weird picks like Coda. Maybe Begonia pulls, but like, I just think it's too odd and it's frightening and dramatic in a way that people don't expect. Yeah, a lot of content warnings also, we should mention. Like, I feel like we're maybe soft shoeing it a little bit here. It's rated R for a reason. So like, if you're going to go see Begonia, maybe consider taking your parents first or something. You know what I mean? Like, don't just walk in there not knowing any better.
Yes, it does get pretty violent eventually. I won't say any more than that. I do think, as far as Oscar talk goes, I think Emma Stone will probably get a nomination. I doubt that she may never win another Oscar just because they don't like to give out more than two of those to people.
She's got
Jesse
two.
Plemons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jesse Plemons, I think definitely. He's carrying the movie largely on his own. He's the main character, and he is just this gross, like, pathetic person, but that like is, you know, has been wronged by this company. Like, he has real gripes with them that are legitimate, and he's kind of taking it out in the wrong way. But yeah, he's just so convinced. He's so he's great. He's so convinced
right.
as his character.
She has to be an alien, because if she's an alien, it explains everything about why my life sucks. And if she's not one, everything falls apart. And like, it's such a fascinating like tipping point to tip your drama on, you know what I mean? She has to be. Everything points to her being an alien, right? Don't you see it too, Don? Like, ugh, it's good stuff. Plemons is great in this. Yeah, he's so greasy. I don't know if he'd get an Oscar for it, but he absolutely deserves a nom. He may deserve the Oscar for what it's worth, but you know. I don't want to talk too much more about it. Any other thoughts on Begonia?
I think I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Begonia?
I absolutely would, with some strong content warnings. It is definitely bold cinema. It's one of my favorites of the year so far. Great performances by Stone, Delbus, and Jesse Plemons. Real exciting stuff. A lot to talk about. Like I said, it reminds me a little bit of One Battle After Another, of Beddington. There's a lot of very clear political allegories being made, but not explicitly. It's more about how people have trouble talking and communicating with each other. But highly recommend. Strong content warning.
Yeah, it's a blast. Would recommend Begonia. Go see it in a theater. It reminds me of Tar. It reminds me a little bit of like John Carpenter's They Live. Like, it is a weird, twisted little movie that absolutely deserves its R rating. Emma Stone's incredible. I think I was just telling Christina earlier this week, I think she might be one of the greatest actresses of all time. We need to start talking about Emma Stone the way we talk about like Glenn Close and Meryl Streep. She's just incredible. And Plemons is well on his way, dude. Like, the two of them bounce off each other so good. Begonia rips. Please go see Begonia in a theater if you can. But right now we're not talking about theatrical. All right. Now, right now we're talking about streaming. All right. We got to talk about a little bit of television very briefly. What do we call this segment, Andy?
It's time for the TV corner. We're just going to do a little quick recap of a couple of things. Mostly the new Rachel Sennett comedy, I Love LA, premiered this past Sunday. That's something we've been talking about. Rachel Sennett, of course, has been in things like Bottoms, Bodies, 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 Shiva Baby. She's an up-and-coming young Hollywood talent and writer, along with Ayo Itabiri. They went to NYU Film School together, are now successful in L.A. So this is their first show, supposed to be in the vein of things like Sex and the City and Girls. And so episode one came out. I watched it, and I was honestly a little disappointed. But before we get into it, I'll tell you the premise. So Rachel Sennett plays Maya, who's a struggling, not actor, but just a struggling professional in LA. She works for a startup company as in kind of like their marketing department. She's hoping to get a raise. Her boss is kind of not playing along. Her kind of estranged friend Tallulah, played by Odessa Azion, who we're going to see shortly in Marty Supreme around Christmas, is very successful. She is an influencer, and she gets paid $10,000 to post everything. She comes kind of crashing into her life, into Maya's life, and she's just nuts. She's like, hey. I got to go to work tomorrow. And that's like, no, next thing they're at the club. And he's like, well, I got to do this. And she's just kind of crazy. And she's like, let's throw a birthday party. Let's go to the beach. She's just like, huge amount of energy. And it just kind of is different from Maya. And, it's revealed that they were good friends, but they've kind of fallen out. And now she's kind of come crashing back into life. And it's just about being young and trying to make it in LA. That's the basic premise. 30-minute comedy. It just was kind of okay.
I can jump in here and give you a chance to breathe.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
I haven't watched it. I need to, but I do want to ask you a couple questions about it. Something that's been surprising to me, though, is Rachel Seno seems to be a kind of a millennial darling. People seem to really go for her. She's funny. She's trendy. Most of all, she's relatively successful, put out a few features. Bottoms, we gave Bottoms a lot of praise here on the podcast. I Used to Be Funny. We covered on the show. Definitely more dramatic, so kind of what she could get into. I Love L.A. was originally, the untitled Rachel Snow project for HBO, which people are really excited about. But all this comes out, and I'm shocked to see on Twitter, dude, people are not going for this. Like, you said it's just all right, and I want to hear more about that. But, like, it just seems like people are over this. People are comparing her to, like, Lena Dunham and Girls, which people over there do not normally look kindly upon, like, which I've also not watched, so I don't know. But, like, what the hell? I thought we got into female creators. Like, what's going on here? Why are people not standing Rachel Snow?
So it's just kind of a dud. It's just not, like, it's not very funny. There's a couple of good jokes, but, like, by comparison, The Chair Company, like, I burst out laughing multiple times during the first episode and in every episode. And on this, I just kind of chuckled a couple of times. There's jokes. It's a very LA thing. There's jokes about rent and going to this club and, oh, they don't. They roofie at that place. You don't want to go over there. They fixed it here. You know, like, there's just not a whole lot. I think it might ring a little bit more with not millennials, with Gen Z. It's definitely for that target audience, but it's not very funny. And the drama isn't enough, because the main heart of this is the relationship between Maya and Tallulah, and how they were friends. They kind of are estranged now. One was very successful, and she's come crashing back into her life. Josh Hutcherson is also in this as the boyfriend. It was just kind of a weak start. I'm gonna give it a few more episodes. I'm excited to see where it goes and give the show a chance. I definitely like everyone involved in it. I'm a big fan of Rachel Sennett as well. But yeah, it was just kind of a dud. It was just kind of okay. And like those shows, again, Girls, I've only watched a handful of episodes of Girls, but it's a really funny show. Sex and the City, of course, is a classic HBO comedy. So, you know, the shoes are big to fill, and it's off to a weak start.
Yeah, it's a bummer, man. Like, I sorry, I'm distracted by this. We got the trailer up on YouTube, and I just stopped on a freeze frame, and it definitely looks like this girl's not wearing pants. She is, I'm sure. I'm sure she's wearing pants. If anyone from YouTube is watching, it's fine. I'm just going to click somewhere else. It's fine. Anyway, I think it's weird because just big expectations fall on Snow a little bit. I think people really expect anything she comes out with to be a banger. And that's kind of crazy, right? Like, nobody should expect, like, whatever she makes is going to be a hit. But also, dude, HBO definitely hyped up in the marketing. Untitled Rachel Snow Project was something we looked at for, like, 8 months. Like,
months.
They would literally put it in trailers for what's coming to the Sunday slate. And they would have footage, and it would say that over the top of an untitled called Untitled Rachel. So, like, very much have been, like, this is going to be hot. Yes, this is going to be cool. Also, notably not from LA, I do want to ask. They say New York movie, the best New York movies make New York a character. Andy, how's LA look in this show? I mean, it seems like from the trailers, there's an awful lot of it.
I mean, it's just kind of, it'd be like if you did the Dallas version and you're just out in the neighborhoods. There's nowhere scenic yet. They talk about going to the beach. They don't. They're in her apartment. Again, I think it's more about the experience of being there and like trying to make it the difficulty. Like she's trying to get a raise, her boss or a promotion. Her boss isn't really listening to her. I will say Odessa Azion is like pretty incredible as the influencer friend because she brings that kind of hype that those people are. She's like a huge, she sucks all the air out of the room kind of character. So she's really fun to watch. Rachel Stennett is kind of a loser in her own comedy. So right. she's just like, she's struggling. There are some good jokes. I might give it a second watch just to give it a fair chance, but I want to keep it going, but it has landed pretty softly.
Let's talk about it. Welcome to Derry. Cause you talked about this a little bit last week. Where are we at? Two episodes are out now.
Yes, two episodes in. This episode two actually premiered on Halloween. They were trying to get in on spooky season, so it didn't premiere on Sunday night like normal. We see just kind of the continuation of our main plot, which I won't get into too big, but again, a child has disappeared. There are suspects, child and adult alike. There is this military plot where they are looking and digging for something, and Dick Halloran from The Shining is in the show, and apparently this is mentioned in the It book, but he is in the show as a young soldier, presumably using The Shining abilities to locate something that the military is interested. We don't know what it is. We're not sure. We kind of have some guesses. Our main character, it was interesting because in the first episode, there's probably five people that you think are the main character, and they're not. It changes. our main character is Clara Stack, who plays Lily Bainbridge. She is the kind of the main person, or one of the two main characters that has been. It's hard to say because it starts with a group that we think is going to be the main group, and then it changes by episode two. But Lily Bainbridge is one of the main characters, along with this young black actress Amanda Christine. They're two friends, and what Amanda Christine is black, and that's a big part because it's taking place in the 60s, and in it is the North, but there's still a lot of racism. Like a lot of Stephen King properties, it's about the real life horrors that are just as bad, if not worse, than the fantastical ones. There's some scary moments. Some of it's kind of cheesy. It's not working for everyone, but I'm enjoying where it's going.
Something I saw, I'm going to say, I don't want to give too much away. I saw a clip on Twitter earlier of a certain scene. It looked like in a store involving a bunch of pickle jars. Good, decent monster design. At least in like the, from what I've seen fleetingly, right? Like you'd kind of think it would just be like Pennywise the Clown, right? Like, and we talked about this a bit last week. Like you got to do more than that. You can't just do Pennywise for eight episodes. It's got to be more creative. Part of how the creature kind of attacks kids, at least in the film, is, you know, coming at them through paintings and all kinds of goofy stuff. So like, I guess, you know, anything's a susceptible scare in it, right?
Yeah, it again, like in the film, it is a manifestation of one's fears, and so those fears are kind of what comes to life. There's lots of different monster designs, and they are all pretty scary. Like I said, the first 10 minutes of the first episode are really intense, and there's some like pretty gross, gnarly, gory stuff. Even in the first 10 minutes, like you'll get the tone just through that. I'm enjoying the show, and I'm definitely excited to see where it goes. There's not enough podcasts about this. I keep looking for like a companion podcast and there's not.
I know. I need to catch up. Like it's two episodes. I feel like people were a little middling on episode two, but even still, like I still got time to jump in. Like if I get too far behind, then before I know it, the season will be over and I'll never jump in. But yeah, I mean, you said Chair Company would recommend. I Love LA. You're going to try it again. Where are you at with it? Welcome to Derry. Going to keep up with it? Fall off?
I mean, I think if you're a horror fan and a Stephen King fan, you're probably going to enjoy it. If you're not, mileage may vary. But we'll see. It's still early. It's early days. They're playing in three seasons. You know, sometimes it shows take a couple of episodes to kind of hit their stride. So I'm sticking with it. Love The Chair Company. I need to catch up on episode four. But man, that show's so funny. And that's the thing. Like, I Love LA looks so tame comparison because I'm just like bursting out laughing. But I want to support female creators, and I want to give it a chance.
Yeah, dude. Likewise. I need to give it a go. All right. Well, thanks for the TV Corner update. We got one more movie to talk about on the podcast this week. I'm going to be taking the summary on it. The movie is Ballad of a Small Player. So, Ballad of a Small Player is the story of Lord Doyle, a down-on-his-out gambler living on the edge of the world in Macaw. Lord Doyle owes money all over the world, and he is pushed out to kind of the edge of the planet here, where gambling is for high rollers only. Only the people with the most money. Only the people with the biggest stakes, where he is set out to win his fortune that's finally come due, right? Just one more win is all I need to get out from under everything. The movie opens with Colin Farrell in a hotel getting ready with his lucky gloves, this kind of signature pair of yellow gloves he's got. Before he sets out for the evening, he heads to a casino, and that's when he... Let's see here. There we go. That video got stuck. Excuse me. That's when he meets, what is her name? Dao Ming. Played by an actress named Fala Chen, who agrees to stake Lord Doyle if he can just get on top of things, that he can dig himself out of debt and maybe help her out too. Also stars Tilda Swinton as a character named Blythe, and is based on a book. And I did not do my research well enough to tell you who. Lawrence Osborne, I believe, wrote the book off the top of my head. I'll figure it out while Andy's talking. But it is an Edward Berger feature, which is important to cinephiles because Edward Berger did All Quiet on the Western Front, won an Oscar for that movie over for Netflix a couple years ago. Then he did Conclave. I think also got Oscars for Conclave, at least something. He did that last year, which was really successful, and now here he is with Ballad of a Small Player. Not on the big screen, notably small screen, but still a big deal. Andy, what did you think of Ballad of a Small Player?
So I went into this with kind of low expectations because I was like, I love Berger, but it's a small release. It's not going straight to Netflix. I wasn't really looking forward to it. I thought it was going to be like a Leaving Las Vegas, long, slow, meditative, like downward spiral. And I ended up really, really enjoying it because it's not that kind of story. It's concerned with different things, but it's just shot brilliantly. Like I've never been to Macau, but it's like Las Vegas of southern China. And it looks incredible. The lights, it's like the Vegas Strip, but it's a little bit different. But just the way it's shot, it just drags you in. But also the way all of... Macau is shot like there's parts where they go to these like dingy apartments and they're on the seaside. But also just the character of Lord Doyle is fascinating because he starts at the bottom. He owes everyone money, but he looks like he's an important person. He's staying at this extravagant hotel, eating lobster. Like he's in a room that's probably $5,000 a night. Drinks Cristal and smokes cigars, but he's in deep. He owes everyone money. He has hardly a cent to his name, and it looks like he's just come here to end it. But that's not really what he's interested in. And what I think is fascinating about this movie is it's not about him overcoming his addiction to gambling, although he's definitely a degenerate gambler. But it's more about his inability to accept himself. Like he wants to be this important person that he's not. It's almost like he wants to be accepted by posh society. So, you know, he goes by this fake name, Lord Doyle. He stays in these extravagantly expensive places. And, he's gambled up to his neck in debt. He owes a lot of people. He's on the run. He owes Loan Shark. He just owes everyone. He just needs just one turnaround. Matt, the movie just moves at a good pace. There's several chase scenes where he's trying to get away from people. There's several card stuff. It doesn't get into the weeds about, you know, gambling and games. It's not concerned with that. It reminds me of a little bit of The Card Counter. Again, it's a character study of someone's inability to accept themselves.
Yeah, I think I like that you mentioned the visuals just to kind of get start here because the visuals of Ballad of a Small Player are easily its best part, next to its lead, Colin Farrell. This movie shot by James Friend, who shot All Quiet on the Western Front for Berger. He shot a few episodes of The Acolyte in between now and then, worked on a couple of the small projects but it's not done anything really big. And it's a shame this isn't on the big screen because this movie looks so good, dude. It looks so good. It is such a good-looking gambling movie. Like, they managed to, like, McCall just has this kind of, like, blue overtone on it during the day, this kind of, like, teal look. But when we get to night, like, all of these reds, like, explode off the screen, your yellows. Like, I love, yeah, just the colors of Farrell's outfit, right? He's got this, Lord Doyle wears this, like, red coat with these, like, signature yellow gloves that are very notable. Like, the LEDs and neons look incredible. The colors of our poker chips, right? The green of a parking garage, like Tilda Swinton's kind of like streak blonde hair with these pink sunglasses. Like, it just, I don't know, like color is so prevalent here, and it's just such a good looking movie. And that's all great setup for Farrell, who is doing incredible work. I rewatched The Batman over Halloween, and he's a penguin in that, and Chris had not watched it with me, and so we were watching, and she was like, oh yeah, I forgot he's in this. I said, God, Farrell is so good in this movie under all that makeup. I said, and then he did the Penguin show for HBO, did 8 episodes of that. Incredible in that, like incredible work. Since then, we saw him in Big Bold Beautiful Journey just a few weeks ago, and he's fine in that. Just like him and Margot Robbie are fine in that. They're doing good work. But this is the juice. Like, this is where Colin Farrell's been spending his time. Like, he is so tremendous as Lord Doyle, this man who looks like he is about to drop of a freaking heart attack for half the movie. Like, covered in sweat, like, breaking out in hives. Everything is going wrong. Absolute panic. And so much of that is set up for every time he gets just a little W, right? And can move it around. Reminds me of Uncut Gems. It is an incredible performance out of Farrell. Like, and he has to put the whole movie on his back because it's not a very big cast. It's pretty lean. Swinton's not in much of it. Like, she's just kind of on the edges as this character who's kind of looking into his past and trying to find out more about him. Like, he is so great in this movie. Farrell, like, incredible, incredible performance from Farrell. All of that to say, it does get a little dreamlike. It does get a little surreal in ways that I worry we have not described in the open here. And I think that may be the thing that pulls people away from this movie.
Yes, just real quick on his performance. Yeah, it's this tour de force thing where he's, I mean, he carries the entire movie. It's largely about him. He's in every single scene. And he has just, he's breaking down nearly the whole time, or he's on the verge of it. Incredible stuff. I had no idea that to expect that. There are some kind of more supernatural, more mystical elements, which I think are appropriate for the setting as well. Like, they visit these, like, it's this funeral pyre, this stuff on the coast. Like I said, him meeting Dao Ming is what really kind of propels things forward. She's a loan shark herself. She's also in deep, but they think they can help each other out. It gets a little slow in the middle, but the beginning, like Act 1 and Act 3 are just on fire, I think. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's this great scene right towards the end of Act 1 when you know, Farrell meets Dao Ming and he's following her up to an apartment building, and he says, statistically, I have to win. That's what life is. It's a game of statistics. Like, eventually, if you keep losing, eventually you have to get a W, right? And she says, no, life is a mysterious gift. And I felt like, God, that's so much of kind of the ideology of what this movie is, a character who believes that eventually it has to work out. Like, it has to. Like, with enough time and enough effort, you will get a dub. And somebody else who says, no. Nah, there's no set anything to this. There's no guarantees in life. I do like where the movie goes. It gets complicated and has some unique horror elements towards the end, but nothing too wild. And I think most of that just comes from the script, right? It's a book. It's based on a book by, I said it at the open, Lawrence Osborne wrote it with a screenplay by Rowan Jaffe. Like, I think it's fine. Like, I think it's a really good excuse to look at some great visuals and Farrell just turning it on. It reminds me a little bit of like a stage play. Like, it goes geographically places, but not a whole lot. Like, you could probably do a version of this smaller and it would work really well. It just ends up being this like really great character study into a guy who's just run away from everything, like evaded all responsibility, thinking that eventually it's going to work out, you know, really fun.
I think the more mystical elements probably work better in book form, and less so in film form. And there's some reveals in things that I think in the book probably went over a little bit better. The last thing I wanted to mention was the score by our favorite Volker Bertelmann, who I was complaining last week. He also did the score for A House of Dynamite, and I was complaining that I was like, man, it sounds like he really just phoned it in. He's using old stuff from his, and I was like, oh, that's why, because he was writing the good stuff for this movie, which is funny because they're both Netflix movies. But man, the score for this I think helps it propel it a long way. I immediately added it to my soundtrack playlist. Really good stuff from him.
Yeah, one more thing I wanted to say before we wrap up. I've been really surprised to see that people suggest that this may be a miss from Edward Berger. I disagree. I don't think it's a miss. I think it's indulgent. In the same way, it very fittingly has the term ballad and is on Netflix. Like, because when you search ballad, you're going to get two things on Netflix: Ballad of a Small Player and Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which was the last Coen Brothers feature, right? And that too was like just kind of this indulgent little side thing. It's like the directors knew that they weren't going straight to theaters. This is going to be something a little different. He's trying something new. He's going into a space he hasn't been in before. It's a little bit of supernatural, a little bit of mystical in here that kind of comes in towards the end. Like, I'm a fan. I got pulled into this movie way more than I thought I would. Yeah, I had thrown it on kind of passively and was like, maybe I'll watch half. I'll do laundry while I'm doing it. Before I knew it, I was hitting credits. Like, so there's something here in Ballad of a Small Player. So if everybody who says this is a miss and it's not good as good as Ed Berger's other work, I'm not so sure. I think it's up to interpretation. But Andy, would you recommend Ballad of a Small Player?
Yeah, I absolutely would. I really enjoyed this. Colin Farrell is given a tour de force performance playing this gambler at the end of his rope seeking redemption at the end of the world. The lights of Macau look incredible. The setting, the city is very vibrant. Good performances all around. Lots of energy. Great score by the great Volker Bertelmann. Not too long, only 100 minutes. Really enjoyed it. Really recommend.
Yeah, same. I think Ballad of a Small Player is a lot of fun, especially because it's available on small screens. Like, you don't have to buy in and go to a theater for 3 hours and pay the price of admission. You can watch it at home on Netflix. Would recommend. Throw it on the big screen. Turn the lights out in the living room. Actually give it a shot. Or watch it on your laptop. Whatever. But either way, like, solid. Like, really keep an eye on Farrell's performance. He's doing something really special in this movie. Watch those visuals. Listen to the soundtrack, all right? Like, it's a bit of an odd story, but it comes from a book. Like, and that's okay. Well, like, but I think the filmmaking trappings around this are undeniable. And with that, that's the episode. Good Lord. Episode 313, Down and Dusted. Andy, what are we watching next week?
So we're going to be taking a look at Predator Badlands, which is a new Predator film. Comes out this Friday, November 7th. And also, finally, Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, which comes out this Friday on Netflix. I'm pretty sure. that's already had some small theatrical releases in L.A. to... It's interesting. At the festivals, it was kind of lukewarmly reviewed, but it's since kind of gained a little bit of momentum. So I'm not real sure what to expect, but we'll be looking forward to that as well. Upcoming releases: The Running Man, Wicked for Good, Zootopia, and as well as a slew of indies that I'm a little unsure of. You never know with these release dates. But next week, Predator, Badlands, and Frankenstein.
I hear Badlands rips. Really looking forward to that. Frankenstein might have the most mixed reviews all year. I feel like I've heard people be like, it's really great and it's clever and he's doing something smart and it's a good adaptation of the book. And other people be like, skip, don't bother. it's a Del Toro dud. So we'll see. I don't know. We'll cover it next week on the pod. Come back, tune in. We'll talk about it. If you enjoyed the episode today, if you like what we're doing here on Off-Script Film Review, best way you can support us is just subscribe to the show. If you're on YouTube, you can subscribe there. If you follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, you can check us out there. Our audio listeners can find us on Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, iHeartMedia. If you want to take us on the go, right? Put Off-Script in your ears. You can do that as well. Let's see. We got the YouTube channel. We're doing big things over there. Our website, offscriptfilmreview.com. And you can email us correspondence directly at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com. Our inbox is open. DMs approved. So send something over. And if it's good stuff, might just read it live on the show. And that's it. Episode 313 of Off-Script Film Review from all of us at Off-Script, the home of bold cinema. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.